Welcome to the Fair Parenting Podcast, where we cover people's stories, ideas, and the progress towards fair parenting.
In this episode, we continue our discussion with Derek McDuff on movies. We recorded both episodes in one session, hence we don't redo the introductions. Last time we spoke about Inception in episode 3, and in this episode, we're going to talk about the movie Interstellar. So here we go. I hope you enjoy it. So this episode, we want to talk about another Christopher Nolan film, Interstellar. Just to mention the chronology of these films, Inception, with its parenting topics or themes, came out in 2010. Interstellar, I think, was 2014.
Yeah.
And 2012, so in between, he did Dark Knight Rises. There is a parental aspect to that film in that the daughter of Ra's al Ghul is the main sort of baddie in that film. But there's not really much to talk about there.
There's a little with like the orphan stuff, you know, and
that's true. Yeah. Like, yeah.
You know, it touches on him being an orphan and then this next orphan, he's Robin, basically. I forget.
Yeah.
John Blake.
That's yeah.
How he's an orphan. And
that's true. Yeah.
So there's that stuff, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. And is it Talia, Ra's al Ghul's child?
Yeah.
So she was estranged from her dad because he excommunicated Bane. And then she sort of felt more warmly to her father after Batman killed him. And that's what really brought her back to her father's legacy of the League of Shadows. So, there's another a parent-child relationship that had got fractured, and the child finds a way back because of something Batman did.
I kind of feel like at this time, Nolan was almost doing two trilogies. Like, he did his Batman trilogy, and then he almost did, like, basically a spiritual trilogy. Like not a literal trilogy, but, you know, people always talk about, like, directors doing spiritual trilogies. And it was, so he kind of did them back-to-back. Like, he first did Batman Begins in 2005, then he does The Prestige in 2006, and then he does Dark Knight, and then he does Inception, does The Dark Knight Rises, and then he does it. So it's almost like this split trilogies. He did one, the real trilogy, and then he did the spiritual trilogy, took turns. Because I do think that Prestige shares a lot of themes with both the films that we've been talking about in the last episode, Inception, and here, Interstellar. I feel like that is really, and it is so much on a smaller scale because The Dark Knight catapulted him to just being the filmmaker. And he's really one of maybe a handful of guys who can still just come up with an original idea and make a multi-million dollar film that's left in Hollywood, that it doesn't have to be based on any pre-existing IP.
Yes.
So I think a lot of that is obviously thanks to The Dark Knight. But I think Prestige really is a good, it fits in with these other two films really well. They fit it really well with each other as well.
Yeah, I did mean to rewatch that. I only thought of that again last night, but I was going to say there was nothing. So I was basically going to, my point, original point was, well, you got Interstellar 4 years after Inception and Dark Knight in the middle. I was going to say, well, Dark Knight's not got these themes in it, but obviously it has, I guess. But I was going to say, so there's that four-year period, 2010 to 2014, and I just wondered, I haven't read about Christopher Nolan, I think, but the amount of parental stuff in those films, it almost makes me think that he saw somebody going through the family court. I don't know if that's the case. And I don't think he has, because he's happily married, isn't he, I think?
I believe so, yeah.
Either that, or maybe he had some sort of, you know, disjointed relationship with a parent. There's just so many themes that are common in these films to do with children and parents. Perhaps we'll go on to, should we discuss Interstellar then?
Yeah.
It's a little bit like Inception in that it plays with time and space, but it's about a father trying to get back to his children. In this case, it's like Inception, he's got two children, but for some reason in Interstellar, he's much closer to the daughter than the son.
He really does not care about Tom at all. Like, he's like, I gotta get back to save Marv, my daughter. And I'm like, I guess you don't care about Timothy Chalamet / Casey Affleck, which, I mean, I was like, all right, I guess, I'm like, is it just because she's like, you know, a brilliant scientist and he's just wants to be a dumb farmer? Like, he's really, he really loves Murph, but he's like, oh yeah, and Tom also, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, although it's kind of reciprocated, because when he goes, You don't see his son crying, but it's Murph who runs out of the house to him, is it? There is a scene very early in the film where he goes to Murph's school and there's some story about the moon landings where they're saying, we didn't land on the moon, and Murph is saying, well, we did. And they're sort of saying, you need to tell Murph that we didn't go to the moon. And he's on Murph's side. So
yeah,
I think there is a, you know, and he was obviously, I think he was an astronaut before, and there is a link between the two of them, and space is a mutual interest that I don't think the son has. As you say, he wants to grow some corn and stuff, which is actually really needed in the film and actually at the moment in real life. I think we need to get some people growing some stuff and, the way the world's going. Yeah, so it starts off, there's some upsetting scenes at the beginning because, you know, Murph is, I'm guessing she's 8 or 9 and when he goes, and they start seeing the signs coming through the bookcase, don't they? Or somebody's trying to communicate with them through this bookcase. Now, they don't know who it is, but there's obviously a real interest there. But Coop has to go, and Murph is pretty distraught about this, and she says to him, you know, go, if you're leaving, just go. And he's saying, like, I don't want to leave like this, but he has to go. And she won't say goodbye. And it's really a touching scene. You know, he gets in his car and he's driving off. And, you know, he's got tears in his eyes as he's doing that. At that stage, Murph changes her mind, rushes out to say goodbye to her dad, but he's gone. And just after that, he's got a pile of junk in his front seat, his passenger seat. And he looks under there because he's hoping that Murph has hidden under there. Because earlier in the film, she does hide under that junk. And he's kind of looks under there hoping that she's there, but she's not. And so neither of them get to say goodbye to each other properly. He does explain to Murph before he goes, when I come back, we might be the same age because of the way that time works in space. And that really upsets Murph because, you know, as a child of maybe 8, to think, you know, somebody of, I don't know how old Coop's supposed to be, 40 or something, that is an, you know, eternity to an 8-year-old. They can't imagine being 16, you know, so they probably see a 40-year-old as an old man, and they just can't, the thought of not seeing your parent for that long, it's really hard for her.
One thing that I was thinking of is, you know, in watching this movie, they're always talking about, like, okay, he had decided to leave his kids and to kind of like save the world or whatever. And like Michael Caine is able to convince him. He's like, you got to go so that your kids will have a future, so that they will be able to survive and stuff like that. And me not having kids, I feel like it definitely hits differently than for someone who does, because I've talked to people like, oh, I wouldn't be able to leave my kids. And, you know, at the end, I'm kind of jumping ahead forward, but like Matt Damon, who is, you know, kind of despicable in this movie, but he is a really interesting quote unquote villain because he is right about a lot of stuff. And he's like, the love that you have, like, it doesn't extend to beyond the whole human race. Like, you will do anything for your kids, but you won't like make the sacrifice of like not seeing them again so that you can save all of humanity or like make sure that humans survive with this plan B. And it's that kind of emotion versus logic thing that I think is really interesting that this movie plays with a lot, and the power of just like kind of love. And how one thing people ding this movie for is the way that they're kind of like, oh yeah, well, love is kind of the ultimate answer, and that's not really built up. But I think it is built up through the entire film, and that way love kind of transcends time and dimensions and gravity and everything else is such a cool thing. Yeah.
Yeah, when he falls into the black hole towards the end, and he's talking to, I think, is it one of the robots he's talking to?
Yeah, Tars, who is my favorite character, by the way. That is, I love Tars so much. He's so sarcastic and great.
I like him when he goes to rescue I think it's the Anne Hathaway character, when they're on that planet where they say, oh, look at the mountains. And he says, they're not mountains.
He's just like, those aren't mountains, those are waves.
So I think she then gets stranded, and one of the robots goes.
Yeah, it's Tars.
And the way he runs is with his metallic limbs is quite inventive.
He is my favorite character. I think in this movie.
That's it, because he keeps turning up and down the humor setting, doesn't he? So when he's in the black hole, Tars is talking to him, and then he's saying, Coop says, you know, love. is the key. My connection with Murph is quantifiable. That is the key. It's going back to what you said about Matt Damon. You know, although they're foes, they're in agreement. The love between the parent and the child is tangible and powerful and is the key to basically saving humanity, because that's what he goes back to do. So it's exactly as you say about, you know, Matt Damon's basically, I think he says, you'll care about what's in your line of sight, i.e. your kids. So yeah, that's pretty powerful. And when I saw that, you know, many years before I was a parent, it kind of came across as a little bit corny. I didn't really, you know, I was a little bit more cynical in those days. And but after you've been through early years of parenting, it does change. And at stage, Christopher Nolan was a parent. So I think he's talking from the heart there, I would guess. An interesting thing about this movie that I hadn't picked up on before is the main emphasis is on Coop saying goodbye to Murph, but also Michael Caine is saying goodbye to his daughter, Brand. They don't see each other again. Because we learn later that Michael Caine, his plan A was basically a lie, had no hope. Did Brand know that?
She did. I'm pretty sure she did not. And I think Michael Caine, it's that same thing of part of the reason he wanted her to go on this mission is because she was going to be one of the few survivors with his plan B. Right. He lied and did this horrible thing to the world where it's like, yeah, everyone on Earth is going to die, but at least he gets to save his daughter. You know, it's that same thing we're talking about where it is that connection that he has to this one person is the one that shines through. I think Brand is such an interesting character. Maybe the most interesting kind of character from a thematic perspective, because she's the one who kind of is constantly talking about love. And it's something that might not get really noticed, but her, because he's not even in the movie, but she talks a lot about her being in love with Edmund, or at least Coop picks up on that she has this love. And that's kind of her reasoning. It's kind of the opposite of his, is like he's leaving Earth and he's leaving the people he loved behind. She's trying to get back to this person that she's in love with. And they have that whole discussion at the end of the second act where it's like, okay, what planet do we go to? We've already lost all this time. These planets are both giving us the green thumbs up. And he kind of argues against her love, like, oh, we can't listen to her judgment. Her judgment is clouded because she just wants to go back to see the guy she's in love with. And she's like, I haven't seen him in 10 years and I'm still feeling this pull, this love that, you know, stretches across dimensions, which is a different kind of love than the love that he has for his daughter, but it's still love and it's still in that theme. And that's something that I related to a lot, you know, because I haven't had kids, but I've definitely been in relationships and, you know, been in relationships that ended and thinking like, oh, like you go across the stars, blah, 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 that whole romantic notion. And it's not really presented in that romantical of a way because it's Nolan and he doesn't really write like that, but the themes are still there and very, very present. She feels very much like a real person going through these kinds of experiences. She doesn't like sugarcoat it and give it all this poetry. And then with that discussion, I never really thought about before rewatching it this time, and I have seen it a number of times, but how important that discussion is and how in choosing to ignore the love that she is feeling when the other two astronauts are like, no, we're going to go over here. We're going to make the more logical choice and not follow your emotional choice. That is the wrong decision. That is the decision that means everything goes wrong, because they go, that planet is obviously a lie. Matt Damon is lying to them. Yeah. Everything goes wrong. Everything, the guy explodes. If they had just listened to her and listened to her love and gone to that planet, she would have gotten back there presumably in time to find Edmunds and maybe, you know, get back together. Or that was a habitable planet. They would have been able to do everything. Coop would have been able to get back to his daughter before she was an old lady. That was the emotional choice and not the logical choice for that, to follow love for her, to follow her heart and try to get back to this man that she loved would have been the correct choice. And I think that's so interesting that while he is all like, all about like, oh, I've got to get back to this person I love. Yeah. He's unable to see, well, not see, he is able to actually pretty easily see that she has these emotions, but he is unable to kind of relate to her and see the plan that she is going to and think that maybe we should listen to this. He knows his own judgments are clouded and he kind of turns that on her, and that ends up being a bad decision ultimately.
Well, yeah, that's really, had passed me all by. It's fascinating to hear you talk about that. I mean, one thing about Coop is, and Murph, is the mother isn't in that film. So we don't know anything about Coop's romantic side. And he's got a strong pull to be with his child. But maybe that's why he can't understand Bran's pull. He can't, maybe he doesn't have that sort of romantic history in his own. Maybe, you know, we don't know what happened to Murph's mother. It might have been a short thing.
They mentioned she died. They mentioned once or twice that she's like buried in the back. And I think John Lithgow says something about like before my daughter died or something, but. They say that she's buried because Casey Affleck's kid died and then John Lithgow dies and they say buried in the back next to mom and grandpa or something like that.
Yes. Okay. I mean, so it could just be that Coop, I think he was an astronaut before, wasn't he, earlier in his life? So, I mean, not that I'm an expert on the romance of astronauts, but it's sort of a solitary kind of, I don't think they get up to much in the space station. So, it may be that he just hasn't got that life experience that Brand has of you know, having that romantic pull.
And I think it's not super clear, but I think that the film is kind of implying that he goes on that journey. Like he doesn't have that really romantic side to him at the start, or at least he's figuratively and literally buried that part of himself. That he kind of gets that back with Brand because the film ends with his daughter telling him, go find Brand. She's out there alone. And she's burying the guy she loved. She's burying Edmund. You see his grave in one of the last scenes in the film, and he kind of goes and flies out into the unknown to go find Brand, who once again be pulled to love, is what I think is the film is trying to say there at the end.
It's just such a powerful film. It's all about love, isn't it? But I totally missed that side of Brand and Coop.
It's very subtle. Very, very subtle.
Yeah. When they meet Murph and Coop at the end, it's so brief. And she, as you say, she basically says, right, off you go find Brandon.
Yeah.
And he doesn't see her for more than a couple of minutes. He's waited, you know, probably 8 decades or 9 decades to see his daughter. And that's that. But
it's interesting because, she has kids. She has grandkids. Yeah. She has this whole big family. She wanted to go see him one last time. But then she says, like, you shouldn't have to see me. Like, she's lived so much more of life than he has at this point. You know, she's experienced all of these things. She's gone off and probably like married Topher Grace and had all these kids and become you know, this huge person. She wanted to see him one last time. She's like, I wanted to see my dad one last time. But she's what, like 80-90 now, and she hasn't seen him since she was 10. So you know, they have that little moment and it's a very touching moment, but then he kind of leaves and you see her surrounded by all these other people that love her. So that's a really powerful moment, I think.
Yeah, there's so many family members there who obviously they don't know Coop at all. And I mean, there's that funny scene when he wakes up and he says, oh, you named the space station after me. And the doctors laugh. Because they don't know really much about him. It's his daughter who saved humanity, although she was able to because of the messages that Coop sent back from the black hole. So,
You get the impression, because the guy kind of is like, oh, I did a paper on you in high school, is that he's like a guy that, he's not like an Abraham Lincoln, he's like a Millard Fillmore. It's like, okay, there's some, like, he's known and he's like a name, but he's less famous than these other people that surround him, you know?
Yeah. So we kind of ended up at the end of that film. But to sort of jump back a little bit, one of the things that Bran says earlier on in the film, when they, I think it's just after they leave Earth, she says about space that nature isn't evil. But they're up there trying to save humanity. Well, if nature isn't evil, almost by implication, she's saying that humans can, you know, if evil exists and nature isn't evil, they almost say, well, yes, we're trying to save humans, but actually they're the evil ones. You know, they're capable of evil. Nature is.
Yeah. But like, yeah, I think she's saying that, like, the world isn't doing this to us. We kind of did this to the world, and, you know, now we're dealing with the consequences.
When they're not able to do communication between each other in real time, they sort of send video messages to each other, don't they?
It's really interesting. I love space films, and that's always a thing. Like, I've just been watching that show For All Mankind, and like, it's the season one when they're like on the moon, it's just like it takes 8 minutes, but then when they go to Mars, it like takes, you know, however many hours to get there. So I think that's a really interesting realistic trope.
But Murph, she's so upset, she doesn't. The first time she sends a video message to Coop is when she's the age he was when he left her. So in other words, I'm guessing maybe 20, 30 years after he left, the son, he does communicate with his father initially. I think he says at one stage, Murph's too upset. And so he's gone all that time without hearing from her. And then eventually she does start communicating with him, and she's working with a Michael Caine character at that. But it just shows how obviously affected she was, that she just didn't want to talk to him. And then she does start talking to him, but Michael Caine then dies and reveals that it was his plan A was a lie, and that, you know, in Michael Caine's view, he was sending Coop away to go with plan B. They would look for plan A, but Michael Caine knew that would fail, and ultimately Coop was sent to enact plan B. At that point, Murph, who has spent the last few decades missing her father, but hoping he would come back, she now has the question, did he know that he was leaving me for good? Mm-hmm. Did he know that we had no chance and we were going to die, but he left us? And she asked that as Michael Caine's about to die. Michael Caine dies before... I keep calling him Michael Caine. It's Professor Brand, isn't it? It's this thing. Some people say Michael Caine is Michael Caine in every film. So perhaps that's why. But to me, you know, he's Michael Caine. He's a superstar. So it's if I was talking about Clint Eastwood, I'd probably be saying Clint Eastwood instead of Dirty Harry.
Well, Clint Eastwood is Clint Eastwood in every movie.
Like, yeah. But with these kind of, you know, mega stars, you kind of just say their name rather than the character sometimes, I think.
Which really is, interestingly enough, I think that they intentionally play on that in this movie, where they're like, oh, who's this random guy then? It's Matt Damon. And he wasn't in like any of the promos or anything. It was just like surprise Matt Damon. And initially you want to like this guy because people like Matt Damon. You're like, oh, cool, it's Matt Damon. And then when he betrays everybody, it's such a betrayal, because it's like, how could you do this to be Matt Damon? You're playing on the persona of the actor. And I love that Matt Damon is just like down to be like, I'll be a horrible, cowardly villain in this movie. Like, it's great. It's interesting because there have been a couple other movies where Matt Damon has been surprised Matt Damon and popped up at the end, mostly Steven Soderbergh stuff. Yeah, I won't say them because I don't want to spoil them. But it's something he's done a couple times, but I think this is the first time, and it's something that I think is just brilliant casting as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, no, it's great. Yeah, he's the bad, like you say, the bad guy. It's just an unexpected role. But actually, is that the moment that when Michael Caine dies and Murph then feels that her dad might have abandoned her? Is that the first time she sends him a message?
No, she sends him a message before that. And she technically, when she sends that message, she's technically sending it to Brand. She's like just basically telling Brand, your father died. I'm just going to tell you because nobody else is going to. Then she's about to turn off the message and she stops and she says to the younger Brand, Brand, did you know? Did you know about this lie? And did my father know? And that's so, and like, you know, you can tell by Anne Hathaway's performance there, like, which is, she's so good. She's a really underrated actress, that she's like, I didn't know. She's like, she starts crying. She's like, she's talking to Coop. She's like, I had no idea about any of this. So even at that point, she was like, I don't want to talk to my dad. I'll tell Brand what needs to be told, and kind of emotionally ask this question.
It's such a painful, because she's gone through a lot. She's lost her dad, but then she thinks, oh, he knew he was not coming back. He knew he was leaving me to die. And it's just so heartbreaking for a child. And of course, he's not there to say, you know, he can't reach her until later in the film. So she goes through decades like this. It's just so heartbreaking to think of a child growing up from about the age of 8 and then go through their whole life. Or into that age that she is, thinking her dad's abandoned her. It's around that age that he comes back through the bookcase, isn't it? But
which I think is so cool, because it's like that, the thing we're talking about, the Inception, is he gives himself the idea. He gives Murph the idea, but they are able to, like, it's him coming back, him kicking off the events, him giving them the directions to NASA, him giving them the coordinates, him putting all of the events into motion himself in this interesting time loop kind of way.
Yeah, it's amazing that the sort of parallels there. And just one thing quickly about this video messaging that they do, where, you know, she's sending a message and he could be getting it in space, you know, years later, and he's sending one back, and, you know, she could be 10 years older by the time it comes back. And That's something that, you know, I've set up an email account for my child, and I have sent emails to her. She can't read them until, you know, maybe another decade or so she'll read them. She'll be able to read them, but they're there, you know, they're out there in almost space, if you want to look at it that way, waiting for her. I thought, just kept that to myself for years, but it's funny, about a week ago, I was on Twitter and I saw this discussion where other parents were doing it to their kids, and they set up messages or Facebook accounts or something, and they were posting stuff for their children to see when they actually became old enough to read it. So it's almost a similar idea, that you're trying to contact your, or you're trying to write a message for your child to read in a decade or so, you know, and you don't know what they're going to be like. It's kind of hard to keep, because when I write to my child, it's kind of hard to know what to say, because you don't know what their personality is going to be like when they read it. You know, you just know this is a little baby at that point. So you just don't know. It's similar here, because these video messages going from the spaceship to Earth, you know, years and years are passing. Murph has got no idea what Coop is like at that stage. And vice versa, you know, Coop doesn't have any idea what his daughter's going to be like at 30 or 40, but he's sending these messages and he might get one back in 10 years or something like that. It's very disjointed, and but you have to do what you can, don't you, to stay in contact with your family. So, well, one other thing that it's got nothing to do with our discussion here, but when I was watching it last week, Interstellar, that I saw that... I love the frozen cloud on one of the planets where I think the spaceship clips it and chips a bit off.
That's such a cool moment. There's so many cool visuals in both of these movies. But yeah, Interstellar has so much cool, just like space stuff like that, that would, you know, theoretically be possible. But yeah, that kind of catches, because you think it's just like a regular establishing shot, and then you're like, oh, whoa, that's cool.
Brilliant. It's brilliant. I don't know where he gets ideas like that. I don't read a lot of science fiction. Maybe that is from a science fiction book or something, but and maybe similar with the waves that look like mountains. I don't know. But
I think a lot of it is like visual, scientifically accurate. So it might maybe not even science fiction, maybe even like, you know, just because I know that he did this movie talk to a lot of like scientists and NASA, and like everything is theoretically possible, you know, up until, you know, the stuff that we just don't know, like the black hole, like what's inside of it, you know, the relativity and like the time traveling stuff. So I think he touched base with a lot of people that were like, okay, what's some really weird, interesting things that could exist in the universe? And they're like, oh, well, you know, frozen clouds or gravity waves or, you know, so I think that stuff is really cool, because it seems sci-fi and like, wow, this is something that's just comes from, you know, the imagination of someone, but it actually could exist in the universe. And I think that's really awesome, that it's one of those things of like reality could be stranger than fiction.
Yeah. Just to go back to Matt Damon, I didn't really understand why he tried to kill Cooper.
That is, I think, kind of convoluted, and it took me a couple watches to get it. But because at that point, Cooper is ready to just abandon the mission. They think, okay, we're going to set up life here. We're going to set up the camp here, because this is like the final place. And Coop is going to use the Endurance to fly back to Earth. And then Matt Damon's like, okay, no, I'm going to use the Endurance actually to get out. I'm going to kill you so you can't use it. And also, B, so you can't tell the other people, can't tell Brand that, hey, this place isn't what it is. So they can't also use the Endurance to fly off. I think he would be fine with them coming back. But he's like, yeah, I can't let Coop get out of here with this spaceship. I have to use it for myself to escape this. I can't go back to Earth. I got to keep going on with the mission and be the hero. He can't let him get away with that. That is kind of weird and convoluted. There's a lot of exposition that happens very quickly. That is one kind of complaint about some Nolan movies that I tend to agree with, a lot more so in Tenet than this, but it's definitely present here, is that some of the audio mixing is not the best. Like I was watching it at night and I kept having to like turn it way up whenever there was like a dialogue scene, and then an action would be happening and things would be exploding, and like the incredible Hans Zimmer score would just be like, brrr, like the organs would just be like, I'm like, oh my God, I had to like turn it down by like 20, just because like otherwise it would wake up my neighbors.
Yeah. I think there was a lot of criticism of when Dark Knight Rises came out. I think there was a lot of criticism that people couldn't hear the dialogue in that. I never had a problem with it, but I know what you mean. I think Inception as well is a film where I heard one reviewer referred to Hans Zimmer's music as, foghorning the dialogue off the screen or something like that. Something like that, but because it's so loud, his music in that film, but it's great.
I mean, I think he won the Oscar for Inception for this, and I'm pretty sure he won the Oscar as well for Interstellar for best score.
Right. Yeah, he's got a background in pop music, actually, Hans Zimmer, but he was never massively successful, although he did used to work. There's a record producer, very famous record producer in England called Trevor Horn, and he actually made the record Video Killed the Radio Star a long time ago. Huh. I don't know if you know that song. It was apparently Hans Zimmer was hanging around the studio when that was being recorded. There's an English pop music program called Top of the Pops, very famous in England, but there's a performance of that song from about 1980. And if you watch it on YouTube, Hans Zimmer is there. You can see him. He actually went on Top of the Pops with the Buggles, the group to do Video Killed the Radio. He's actually on there performing it. So he has a very long history.
That's cool. A lot of these like guys, these composers that are really popular these days have, I feel like, less of a classical background and more of a, like you were saying, a pop background. And I think that's a lot reason why scores these days are so diverse and interesting. And obviously you mentioned Hans Zimmer, but then you've got, Trent Reznor, you've got Danny Elfman. These guys have these kind of interesting careers like that.
Another interesting thing about Hans Zimmer is somebody who used to do a lot of records with Trevor Horn. He used to co-produce them and engineer them in the 80s. Is a guy called Steve Lipson. And he actually now produces a lot of Hans Zimmer's scores. That kind of lineage from, 1979 with the Buggles through to the most recent James Bond score Hans Zimmer did. It was produced by Steve Lipson, and Steve Lipson worked with Trevor Horn. So there's a whole lineage there of those three people and those records and scores all linking together over 40 years. Yeah. A score I always loved, but I didn't know Hans Zimmer when it came out, but I rewatched the film about 6 months ago, and I was like, I always loved the score. And then I looked at the credits at the end of it, and I was like, and I think it's one of his first scores was True Romance.
Oh, okay. I didn't know he did that.
It's a great film, True Romance. I love it. And it was just interesting to sort of go, I didn't know Hans Zimmer particularly in the early 90s. But to then be a fan of his now and then discover that, he did that too, that I liked. I like Hans Zimmer, but I don't sort of look out all of his scores. So I kind of found that organically. Another example of that is the movie Hannibal, which, I love the score for this, but I didn't know Hans Zimmer had done it and I didn't look it up.
He does a lot of Scott's films, I think, Ridley Scott's films.
Yeah, I'd love to see him live too. Was he there with a? Yeah. He must have been there with a full orchestra, was he?
It was a full orchestra, and I think Tina Gow was on the violin. So it was weird because like the next stage over, Lorde was playing, and it was just like such a. And I just had to split my time between that and Tovlo, who I'm also a really big fan of. So I kind of like split my time between them, and I was like running over to try and catch as much as I could of Hans and the Dark Knight theme is playing as I'm running, and just it was so cool.
Yeah, Matt Damon, actually, he's a bad guy in two ways. I mean, first, he tries to kill Coop, but the way he does it, earlier on, we talked about him explaining about somebody will do more for their kids than humanity. That's Matt Damon's take on things. But he also says that at the moment of death, you see your child's face and you push harder to survive for them. And then as he's trying to kill Coop, he torments him. He doesn't just try and kill him. He actually says, can you see your child's face? It's almost like he's, because, if I link this to parental alienation, there are many parents who are cut off from their kids by how do you want to describe them? Let's just say a nasty parent. And some of these parents are incredibly vindictive. They're taking a child away from a parent, and some of them laugh about it, or they'll torment them, or they'll... I heard a friend the other day describing how the child's, almost dangled in front of them, but he can't see them. He'll get like a video call or something, but you can see them but you can't quite touch them. Do you see what I mean? It's the targeted parent is almost tormented by the nasty parent. It's not enough that they take the kids away. Some of them are so nasty that they try to literally then just destroy the other parent with grief or, you know, whatever. It's so nasty. But that's kind of, you know, what Matt Damon's doing. He could have just tried to kill Coop, but he has to say, can you see your child? You're about to die. Can you see, you know, and it's just, why would you say that? You know, it's,
I had a slightly different read on Damon right there. And I think that Damon, he thinks he is the main character. And I think that's another reason why you cast Matt Damon is because in a lot of movies, he would be cast as the main character in a film like this. Like he was in The Martian right around the same time. And he thinks, like, he has that line where he's like, I thought I was prepared to die, but I never had even considered the possibility that my planet wouldn't be it. Because in another movie, Matt Damon is like the guy, he's the main character. He's the solo protagonist with no ties or anything. And this movie is not at all concerned with that. And it kind of takes that facade that he has and kind of just is like, yeah, this guy is selfish. He is, you know, he's talking about doing this all for humanity and stuff like that. But he is just kind of only doing this for himself.
Yes.
And when he's saying that to Cooper, it's not mean-spirited. It's just kind of, he's almost trying to comfort him, but he's doing such I feel like he's like, yeah, you'll have this. You have this. He's kind of like, I feel like trying to make up for, like, he's like, yeah, I did this horrible thing to you, but at least you get to like see your kids in your mind as you're dying. Like you at least have this nice moment. And then he's like, I thought I could stay here and be with you while you die and kind of comfort you. But he's like, I can't. And he's even too much of a coward to live with the consequences of his own actions. And that's what that spoke for me was like, okay, he can't live with the consequences of his actions. So he's just trying to kind of appease himself and be like, yeah, Cooper, you're fine. You're dying, but at least you get to go out in a good way thinking of your kids. All right, bye. I can't watch you.
Yeah. Okay, well, yeah, I mean, I can see what you're saying. Either way, it's pretty, if you want to be as charitable as you can be to that character, I guess you could say he was clumsy and a coward, but...
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not defending him for sure. I think that that's part of the reason why he is such an interesting character, because he's not vindictive or evil, I don't think. I think he's just very, very selfish and is able to justify... It's for him that the ends always justify the means, you know? Like, he's this character that we've talked about how important love is in the movie, and he's this character that is utterly without a connection, utterly is without anyone that he loves. Mm. And we talked about earlier, like, oh, Anne Hathaway mentions, like, nature's not evil, and, you know, that implication that maybe man is evil, and, like, it's pretty on the nose that this guy is, his name is Dr. Man. He is kind of a stand-in for these aspects of humanity that maybe are not the greatest. So I don't even know, like, you know, talking about the alienating parents, I don't know, it maybe I don't really know too much about it, but maybe that is some parents who are just kind of trying to appease and be like, oh, here's a picture, you're fine, don't worry. I don't know, but that could be something that you could draw a parallel.
I don't think
maybe
so,
not.
I'll give Matt Damon a pass, but not.
I'm not saying he gets a pass. No passes should be given to him.
I'm sure there's some confused parents out there who don't realize what they're doing, but I think, unfortunately, I think a lot of them do know exactly what they're doing. It's just too calculated to say, oh, I didn't really mean that, especially when it goes on for years and years and years. You know, it's not like a one-off. And a lot of them don't change even when you tell them, you know. So, Okay, so just a point about the film that I just didn't understand. Why does, you know, Matt Damon walks towards the spaceship and it then blows up? What was the cause of that? Was it just an accident or was there something that I've missed there?
Yeah, that part always confused me too. The way I took it was that he kind of sabotaged his robot. And you know, that's why he was like, hey, don't worry about it. Don't even fix it. Don't go over there. Because his robot would have told them, hey, don't come here. Like, this is this is all fake. And so he kind of, you know, messed with it. And then when they tried to fix it, it blew up. That's my reading on it. But yeah, that part is kind of unclear.
So then he takes off and he tries to dock on his own with the space station. And why is it just that he's not skilled enough to do it? Because he crashes, doesn't he? Is that just because they tell him, don't do it. And he does. And he,
Because they say that they disabled the auto lock. So he has to do it manually. And when it does it manually, it does it imperfectly. And he cuts off most of that conversation. I think that is, again, him believing that he is this main character, that he's this great man, the great hero who can go and he's going to go and do this thing. And they're just telling him. And it's so great because he's in the middle of this, this seems like speech. He's like, there is a moment. And he just gets cuts off by exploding. He's just really undone by his own hubris. And I love that moment. And I don't know if I caught it before, but they're like, okay, he's going to be able to dock. And then they're like, oh, Tara's disabled the auto lock, the auto system or whatever. Yeah. And they're like, oh, Tara's, you did that? And Coop says to him, what's your trust percentage at? And he's like, lower than yours. So that's a really great line.
Yeah. So then we get, Coop docks. He's obviously a pretty good pilot.
Great scene.
Yeah, yeah. And then he ends up in the black hole because they need to shed weight, don't they? And so he lets Brand survive because he jettisons himself. I don't know at that point if he knows that he's going to end up in the black hole. Maybe that's part of his plan. I'd have to rewatch.
I think, because he talks about before him and Tars talk about Tars is going to go in and get this data and he's doing the same thing. So I think pretty sure he knows he's going to the black hole, but he doesn't know what he's going to find there.
No, I guess at that point, it's his only chance to get back to Murph, because if he does, carries on, he might find a habitable planet, but he won't get back to Earth.
Exactly,
So when he gets into the black hole, he sees the room back in his house with Murph in it, and he cries out, don't let me leave, Murph. He's looking almost back, he's looking back in time, isn't he, at the scene where he leaves. And I don't really know why it's almost as if he doesn't want to have left, but then that's the only chance of saving the world. So maybe that's just pure emotion from him talking there. I don't know. But obviously for anyone looking at a scene where you're leaving a loved one, you could cry out, don't let me leave, even if it wasn't the logical thing. But yeah, then he goes on to say that line we covered earlier about that his connection with Murph is quantifiable and it's the key. And that's the point of the film, I think, as we've sort of covered, that love is a strong part of humanity and particularly between sort of family members, that it might be stronger between them than caring about humanity. Again, I just didn't get that so much. It seemed a little corny when I watched it before becoming a parent, but I think Christopher Nolan's obviously writing, he was a parent at that point, and I think he's writing from the heart there.
That's what I was kind of alluding to earlier, is like that scene always felt like I'm like, okay, would you leave, your kids behind to try and save the world and stuff like that? And I think that's what Matt Damon's hinting at. Like, he's like, oh, people can't see beyond of their circle. And, for me, I've always been like, well, I understand, I guess, his reasoning, but I'm like, I can't agree with it at all. And has, you said it seemed corny from before you were a parent. Has your perspective and or understanding of it at all changed since becoming a parent, do you think?
Yes. Yeah, I get it now. But that, I think, with Christopher Nolan, he was writing it as a parent. And so it was never meant to be or seem corny. I was just, before I became a parent, I was, I was a sort of a bit more immature and, a bit cynical. And I was like, you see this guy flying through space talking about how he loves his kids. He's probably a bit like, oh, give me a break sort of thing, let's see an alien or something, I don't know, it was about, nearly 10 years ago now. So, yeah, I'd say I was just a bit younger and a bit more, and nobody had forced me away from my kids at that point. So, I think a lot, it changes you. And, as I say, I don't know whether Christopher Nolan has a history of seeing somebody separated from the kids, or it may be just that the way he works, it might be that he's separated from his kids while he's making films. I don't know.
Yeah, that might be it,
I mean, there's lots of professional actors, they go away from their children, sports players, tennis players, or people that are on some sort of, golf circuit or whatever. Yeah, lots of jobs involve you from being away from your children. So it may just be something like that. He may have just been missing his children and it seeped into the script.
Yeah, I mean, it's something you hear about a lot. Like, I was listening to some interview with Bob Odenkirk, and he was talking about, not sure if he wanted to do Better Call Saul when it was starting because he had missed, missed a lot of his kids' time being on Breaking Bad, and he's like, I don't know if I want to go through this again, do the Better Call Saul, and be away for 6 months of the year and stuff. So it's definitely something that a lot of these professionals, whether it be athletes or directors or actors, have to deal with?
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned Trevor Horn earlier. I talk about him a lot. He's an absolute hero of mine musically. I heard an interview with him where they said, "Oh, so what are you up to these days?" And he said, "Well, one of the most important things is being a parent." And this was, I heard the interview maybe 10 years ago, and I thought, oh, but his records are far more important than that, because, you know, he's leaving them behind for the whole world. You know, he makes these fantastic records nobody else could make. And, you know, being a parent, anyone can do that. But again, I was talking from a perspective of just not having any clue. You know, for me, at that stage, records were the most important thing. Music was the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And for me, I had no idea what being a parent was. So to hear that and what you say about Bob Odenkirk, I'd be thinking, go make Better Call Saul, forget the kids. But now I can kind of see, it's just given me a whole new perspective. I think people go on about being a parent too much, and I'm probably doing it now with these podcasts. You know, I'm only really doing it because I'm looking at the sort of the tragic side where a parent separated from a child. If that hadn't happened to me, I wouldn't talk about. Sometimes you get these parents and all they talk about are their kids. And before you're a parent, and actually sometimes after a parent, you just sort of think, oh, don't, just, you know, I've had enough. Yeah. You got to hear about your kids. You know, I think there's, I think people can go on about being a parent to death, really. Other than outside of this arena, I don't really talk about being a parent a lot, because I know it probably bores the hell out of a lot of people, and it used to bore the hell out of me. You know, so, but it's like when you get, say, maybe a coworker comes back and he wants to show you his holiday snaps with his kids in, and you're just like, I don't care, you know.
I always think of that moment on The Office where they're showing, like, Pam and Jim are showing Will Ferrell their baby pictures, and it's like, this baby could be the star of a show called Babies I Don't Care About.
That's the thing with The Office, is I only watched the British one. It was that was so big over here, and I haven't really watched the American, because I the British one, there was sort of like, I think, the 12 episodes and then a couple of longer
stuff. They have like the Christmas special or whatever.
So I've totally missed the American one, but I know there's like loads and loads of episodes of that, so I should probably catch up on it, because I'm guessing that the humor is a bit like the British one, but there's just more episodes of it.
Yeah, there are definitely some similarities between the two. The first episode is like basically exactly the same, but after that, they're completely divergent. You know, I mean, it's much more American style humor, as you would expect. But yeah, it's really good stuff. You know, with it being on so long, there's definitely more ups and downs. Whereas I do appreciate that the British one just kind of got in there and got out. But there is a lot that they do allow the characters to grow a lot more with the extra time. So, you know, there's benefits and, you know, drawbacks to each of them.
Well, Better Call Saul, that we can't talk about that, otherwise we're talking all night. But he did a tour in England back in March, and I was going to go see him, but I was ill. I was very ill that week, so I missed it. But I'd have loved to have seen him in person. Yeah, obviously the show's just finished. What an amazing thing that was. But just to come back to Interstellar, really the only thing left there is the ending scene that we touched on before. It's when he comes back, Murph has been in, she went into cryosleep for 2 years in order to see her dad one last time. She's with all of her family, who her dad doesn't know, obviously. And there's just a really nice scene between them where Murph says, "Nobody believed me, but I knew you'd come back." And Coop says, "How?" And she says, "Because my dad promised me." Just a really powerful moment between the two of them. Her dad promised her. So even though it was 7-8 decades had passed, she still knew that although he could be anywhere out in space and anything could have happened, she still had the faith that she'd see him again. And again, for alienated parents, that is, you know, some of them, especially the ones that don't go to family court, maybe they can't afford it or whatever. A lot of them are just totally cut off from their kids. And maybe they'll see their children when they're 18 or 28, or who knows. At some point, the child will hopefully get curious and look their father or their mother up. They may have not seen, you know, 8 decades on, I wouldn't think, but seen similar. There's not It's funny the word alienated because this is a space film, so it's almost you've got the word alien in there anyway. But yeah, it's not a parent who's alienating them in this. It's humanity's plight. You know, he's got to go, and to see it all work out in the end, and to see. I mean, it was great acting there between the two of them to see the father and the child. You really did feel that they, although, you know, Murph had lived her whole life, you really could imagine, you know, they had that same feeling that they had back when she was a child, you know, in that, and you could see it was still there, despite all the knowledge and the life that was missing for both of them. It almost didn't matter, you know, that family parent-child bond was all that they needed, you know.
Yeah, it's a really touching scene.
Yeah, but interestingly, they didn't end it there. It would have been perfect to end it on that note. But as you say, it then goes off and she says, go and find Brand. And that's what he did. And I hadn't thought about it, but you might be right that he's devoted his whole life to A, being a parent, and B, saving humanity. And maybe she's saying to him now, as you said earlier, you know, maybe it's now time for him to go and find a relationship, you know, a romantic relationship, because he doesn't seem to have had that up till then.
Yeah, and even John Lithgow earlier in the movie kind of like, hey, you know, there's the teacher's single, she's pretty, you know.
Yeah.
And he's just kind of like, I'm not interested in that at all. And to see, this kind of come full circle, and he is the side of himself that he wouldn't even consider a romantic relationship earlier on in the film. And now that seems to be kind of where he's heading, I think, is a really interesting and great arc for him.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I mean, I think a lot of people would have ended the film with Murph and him and Coop meeting, but that extra piece that with the sort of narrative that I hadn't realized, but you've told us about, it actually just pushes it on that bit further and it does add to the ending. So, this is obviously the mark of a great filmmaker, as Christopher Nolan is. So good job. I'm not writing scripts. Let's leave it to the people that know what they're doing. So that's it, really. We still don't know why Christopher Nolan's got all of this in these films, but I guess he might like it that way, leave a little bit open to interpretation. That's fine. It's just nice that that's there to be uncovered. Maybe I'm a bit slow. It took me years to find these extra parts in the film. And as you say, there's other parts that I probably haven't realised and other ways of looking at these films again. And it's just a mark of how good the films are, I guess.
Yeah, definitely can look at them. You know, that's the mark of a great film, is you can take your own history into it and get something completely different than someone else might get. And, you know, it'll still speak to both of us. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about your podcast and your social media links now, because you say you cover a lot of underrated films. So the interesting thing about Christopher Nolan is he makes these kind of films, but they're still blockbusters.
I was going to say, yeah, he's one of the few guys who can make these blockbuster films that are like this.
Yeah, so I'm guessing a lot of the more layered, deeper films that you can get more out of as time goes on and you develop as a person, I'm guessing a lot of those may be underrated ones because they tend to be blockbusters. I mean, so would your underrated podcast cover movies like that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. A lot of the films that I try to cover are ones that have these deeper meanings and stuff like that. And usually they're not blockbusters. Sometimes they can be. I think the first film we ever covered, sometimes they're blockbuster failures. And I think it's because they have all these deep themes that don't necessarily hit or resonate, or people might miss or misinterpret things. The first film we ever did was Speed Racer, which was a huge blockbuster failure, but it's one of my favorite films ever. Like you were saying, the podcast is called Underrated, and we talk about underrated and under the radar movies that are just not connected with people for whatever the right reason that we want to reintroduce people to. So we're on all the podcast apps. Look up Undercast Company. That's the name of our podcasting kind of little group that we have. We're on all the social media. So however you're listening to this, check out Underrated on that podcast app as well, or your preferred podcast app, and follow us on social media. I do a lot of other writing stuff. You can just look up Derek McDuff on Medium, or look up my Linktree. It's just linktree.com/Derek McDuff.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, thanks very much for discussing these films, the two episodes. It's been really interesting and really insightful. Rewatching them myself, I picked up on a lot of things I hadn't seen before, but there's been so much that you've added that I hadn't seen, you know, I wouldn't have got in a million years. So thanks very much for adding that.
Thank you. Yeah, I love discussing film and maybe bringing some new dimensions to it. That's always fun.
Yeah, and you give me some ideas for other films as well that we could maybe do in the future for other episodes. So thanks very much. I've really enjoyed it, Derek. And
Thank you. I'm honored to be your first guest.
Okay, thanks a lot. I just really enjoyed talking with Derek about the movies and songs. A couple of points. I mentioned that Steve Lipson produced the latest James Bond score for Hans Zimmer. I think he just did the theme song, although he has produced soundtracks for Hans Zimmer. Also, I mentioned that Hans Zimmer performed on Top of the Pops with the Buggles doing Video Killed the Radio Star. If you search on YouTube, you'll find that the song was actually Living in the Plastic Age that he was there performing with them. Interestingly, though, he is actually in the video for Video Killed the Radio Star. It's brief, and you'll have to pay careful attention to see him. And it's very cool to see him in that. Him, Steve Lipson, and Trevor Horn are all big musical heroes of mine. Okay, that's it for this episode. Thanks again to Derek McDuff. I just thought his insights were amazing, and I really enjoyed talking about the films with him, and I hope you enjoyed listening. I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Please join us next time.